Welcome to Franchise Festival, where we go in-depth with noteworthy video game series from the last 40 years. For Season 5, we're working through BioWare's Mass Effect. Be sure to let us know what you think by emailing franchisefestival@gmail.com or reaching out through our website at patreon.com/franchisefestival. As for us, we're your hosts, Chris,
Spencer,
Adam Hamilton,
and today is our first ever listener mailbag episode, to the best of our recollection. We've been doing this for a few years. If we did a mailbag episode before, we apologize, but we think this is the first. Y'all had such great insights on the Mass Effect trilogy that we wanted to highlight some of our favorite responses that you gave over at The Avocado, a pop culture website where these shows are shared monthly. And for this episode, we are focusing on comments given to Mass Effect 1 and Mass Effect 2. So we do plan to check out your comments to Mass Effect 3 and Andromeda in the future. Before we get started here, I did want to give the quick caveat that I may have edited a handful of these extremely lightly, just for grammar, that sort of thing, because we all throw caution to the wind when we write a comment into the internet, and so just for ease of listening, I may have edited these very lightly. So please don't take offense if your comment was slightly truncated. And also, we are straight up reading these, so if anybody stumbles on the words or anything, again, please give us some grace with that. So our first set of comments here is on Mass Effect 1. And the first of these is from user Stars They Come and Go. Oh mama, there's so much I want to chime in with, especially the aliens and their lore. To start with the Krogan, rhinoceros dinosaur turtle hybrids with strong Klingon vibes, were plucked off their homeworld by the Solarians to fight in a war with the Arachnoids. Arachnoids. I'm trying to think here. Rachni.
Okay.
I was going to say, after the disclaimer that Chris edited these for grammar and spelling, there's a typo in the notes. There's multiple typos in the notes on the first question.
Well, I didn't edit them very much. That's awesome. Sorry for butchering your comments, Stars. To continue. Due to the Krogan's extreme durability, fighting prowess, and procreation rates, unfortunately, after that war, the Krogans took the far more advanced tech and spacefaring ways to expand, conquer, and pirate nearby worlds, eventually coming to a head when they took an Asari world. Who launched a preemptive attack? The Turians entered the Calamitous War, saving everybody's butts, by bringing the Krogans to a standstill before the Solarians used the Genophage to end the war, akin to the use of World War II's A-bombs. Fun fact, possibly not uncovered until Mass Effect 2 or 3, the Genophage wasn't meant to wipe out the Krogans. The Krogans were simply too violent and self-destructive to harness the 1 in 20 births to return their species to normality. Other weird notable species issues include many resembling their fantasy or Star Trek counterparts. For example, Asari and Solarians respectively resemble elves and Vulcans, while the Volus resemble dwarves or Ferengi, etc. I have also heard we're out of the comment now. This is just Chris. I've also heard the Turians referred to as Mass Effect's orcs, which, maybe. And the Krogan referred to as Mass Effect's ogres, which I buy.
In reference to what?
Warhammer
40K?
No. Like Dungeons and Dragons or okay. Lord of the Rings, you know?
I think Lord of the Rings. Like, yeah. Because the Lord of the Rings orcs kind of had, some of them had more human vibes than like the orcs I'm accustomed to with like Dungeons and Dragons and World of Warcraft and things like that.
Right.
I'm being really thrown by the Turian to orc comparison.
Okay, so candidly, I was listening to the Watch Out for Fireballs episode on Mass Effect during my workout today, and they brought it up there as Turians are orcs. And I thought that there's something there, because Turians aren't quite anything, right? Like, they're bird, bug people who have, like, kind of a martial culture. It's one of Mass Effect's strengths, I think, is that Turians don't really map onto it. Anything too specifically from fantasy or sci-fi media, but yeah, I don't know, orcs, maybe,
or more akin to, like, again, World of Warcraft, like the what am I trying to think of?
Trolls. Yeah, I never think of trolls. I just think the only thing that I ever think of with trolls is that they're weak to fire in Dungeons and Dragons, because whenever I played Baldur's Gate, I had to hit them with a fire arrow.
Or else they just keep getting back up.
You're darn right. Mm-hmm. All right. Spencer, you want to take this next one here?
Sure. Let me muscle my windows here so that I can talk directly into my microphone while reading it.
Do it.
From Lord Stoneheart. Looking it up, Icewind Dale 2's source code is the One Lost to Time, which means no official enhanced edition from Beamdog. But I think a bunch of people did a comprehensive mod that updates the game and advertised it on Beamdog's forums.
That's rad.
Did we have a segment on Icewind Dale in Mass Effect that I forgot about?
Yeah, very brief segment in the first. We're reaching back. At this point, we've been doing this season for almost 2 years. So, some of us have had children in that time.
Yeah. I know, right?
So, you know, we're reaching back a little bit here. I will say, I remember just reading about this, that one of the things that we highlighted in our first Mass Effect, like, development history episode was BioWare's history with the Dungeons & Dragons license. Mm. And so they did, I want to say, they did Baldur's Gate and Baldur's Gate 2, I want to say.
BioWare, yeah.
Yeah, and then they also did...
Presumably Icewind Dale and Planescape Torment?
I'm not sure that they did, actually. I think I want to say Planescape was Oblivion. Is it Oblivion? Obsidian. Boy, howdy, this is a real shoot-from-the-hip episode here.
It was Black Isle.
Black Isle, that's
Black
it.
Isle, the people from Black Isle later basically formed Obsidian, so you're kind of right, yeah.
Okay, I gotcha. But anyway, we talked about in that episode how the source code had been lost for one of those late 90s Dungeons & Dragons computer role-playing games, and Lord Stoneheart mercifully clarified that it was Icewind Dale 2, which is why Icewind Dale 2 is always notoriously absent on any of the remastered collections, which is a drag, because Icewind Dale 2, I recall being a lot of fun.
This is weird. My real-time fact-checking, I guess, so Baldur's Gate was developed by BioWare, but published by Black Isle? I get so confused by the developer-publisher relationship in the gaming industry, because, like, half the publishers are also developers.
Yes, it varies radically, and it varies across regions as well, because publishers and developers are a little bit different, whether you're, like, in North America, Europe, or Japan.
I should really probably, like, figure that out, since... to a video game podcast.
Nah. We don't claim to be professionals. We all have day jobs, for goodness sake.
Not that I'm not passionate about the comments, mind you.
Of course. The comments stand alone.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of comments, Hamilton, you want to take the third one here?
Sure. So, is this Kai Jigger Desu?
This person, I am a frequenter of the Avocado forums. I love the Avocado. It's spun off from the AV Club some years back, and it's a really warm, welcoming community. And Kajigger Desu, which is how I've always wanted to say this, has an image of a character from the show Futurama who says things like Kajigger. So I don't know what the Desu is, but this is their screen name.
Desu is an anime thing.
I think it's an anime thing, like I'm Kajigger, I think, or something of that nature.
Okay.
Like, might even go beyond my nerdiness.
I believe you.
But, so yeah, Kajigger Desu says, love ME1, even with all of his jankiness. Boy, howdy, does it have it. The first time I got to the Citadel, I couldn't believe how big it was. It did feel like an intergalactic hub, and look at all those little weirdos.
Darn right.
I read every single codex entry about every single race and event. Yeah, there's a lot of lore in this game.
Yeah.
Oh, the codex says this planet has a different atmosphere, and it mentions the implications. That's neat. It's full to the brim with lore. Besides that, I love the crew. Tali, Garrus, Rex. Hell, even Liara agree. The humans, I could live without them. Lol.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. It's great. And the quality of life, I think it's...
Yep. Yeah, QOL, quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Changes in the Legendary Edition are pretty good.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah, I am with you, Kajigger Disu. For not having fooled around with a bunch of the side quests, I read every planet encyclopedia entry to the last letter. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I just find it fun reading about planets.
Yeah.
Terry Brunson writes, the Paragon and Renegade system in Mass Effect 1 is so cartoonishly black and white that it's actually hysterical. I unironically love it. Paragon response is pretty much, I'm Helpy McHelperton. And every Renegade response is some form of war crime based on logic that only a sociopath could support. One thing I did like reading about was that the developers announced that most players saved Rachni from destruction. Like, yeah, they started intergalactic war, but they were mind-controlled, and even if they weren't, that doesn't justify genocide. I feel like gamers get a lot of rightful crap for being crappy people, but that was a good example of how most people who play games really aren't trying to do evil things.
I actually, this came up, I was listening to a video essay on Fallout New Vegas yesterday, yeah. Weirdly enough, and they brought up, I guess BioWare got, they like had the metrics for what choices people made in Mass Effect 1, and something like, I want to say the number was 92% of players chose Paragon options.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a huge number.
At least on first playthrough.
Neat.
Yeah.
What's our next comment here, Spencer?
From Cedric the Owl, our
patron. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As for the backgrounds, I believe the biggest gameplay difference they give is that each service record, and maybe each origin as well, has a dedicated side quest associated with it. Soul Survivor Shep is the only one is the only person to survive a Thresher Maw attack, which is later revealed to be a result of Cerberus testing a weapon to attract them for their own ends. This makes allying with them in ME2 really hard for my Shep to justify in character.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That was something that we talked about, us being unsure of how much the origin stories affected the ongoing plot of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can come across as maybe a little bit flimsy, because the events of the game don't differ meaningfully regardless of what your origin story is. But it sounds like they do add a lot of flavor to your Shepard's choices. Like, yeah, if your Shepard's historical trauma was the result of Cerberus, how much harder it must have been for Shepard to join Cerberus in Mass Effect 2. That's really interesting.
Hmm. I mean, I also just like screwing Cerberus over every chance I got in the second game. That's kind of just funny.
Right. It would add a little bit of like if you had to join them for plot reasons, but then screwed them over at every opportunity, and it's because you knew, you know, they got you in the past.
Gotta stick it to the man, the elusive man.
Yeah.
When does that quest show up? Because I feel like I recall us discussing how Cerberus, despite playing such a massive role in ME2, doesn't really show up a lot in Mass Effect 1. Like, there's like that big quest with them in DLC content, and other than that, they're just sort of on the periphery. But
it's a good question. Cedric the Owl, if you're hearing this and want to follow up with when it talks about Cerberus's role in that Thresher Maw attack, please let us know. Because I'd be curious if it was in Mass Effect 1, or if they kind of filled it in Mass Effect 2 to add a little bit more shade to that origin.
Yeah, we need to cover it on our listener responses to the listener response episode.
We're through the looking glass here, people. All right, Hamilton, you have got a long one here. Can you give us the next comment?
Sure thing. Anything for our patron, Jarethan.
Yep, sure enough.
Jarethan says, this was fun, as I started listening to the episode right after Pharos. Realized that I had never done Rex's armor quest because the cast, the only quest I would have missed, I think. Even got the completionist trophy. I guess it makes sense that there would be one.
Yeah.
Then basically listened concurrently as I ran much of the end of the game. with only maybe 20 minutes saved after that. So probably just rushing to the end of the game.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. It was really engaging listening to everyone's thoughts about decisions made minutes to hours, at most, after I made my own.
Mm-hmm.
A shout out. And Hamilton, it turns out, is so right all the time. Ah.
I really wanted you to get this comment. Sweet vindication at last.
Yes. The game is so janky and weird that it even as it's much improved with the original release, the complete lack of utility in the cover system means it's so much running around in the open, firing powers and weapons as fast as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris, because I'm going to give some vindication to Chris as well.
Oh, yeah.
He's also right.
We're all getting our flowers today.
Yeah, yeah. You upgrade your powers, and the net effect is so subdued. I was an engineer. Hey, same! See? Mm-hmm. We understand each other, Jeff. And while I certainly use my powers often, the assault rifle, only half leveled by the endgame or so, was still way more effective 90% of the time. Yes!
Yeah.
Yes, you could stick to one weapon and you'd be just fine. It was so weird.
Mm-hmm.
Anywho, getting Saren to off himself, yeah, create some empathy for the character. Such a unique moment, but it's also something you don't forget, especially when it's chased by his metallic final form. And if you go straight to ME2, I forget who did the cast, who on the cast did that.
That was you, Hamilton. That was you. You went straight from ME1 to ME2.
I did.
Yeah.
That's right. I went through pretty much all three of the, at once. But anywho,
mm-hmm.
The change in visual fidelity and smoothness is jarring. Boy, howdy is it. As much as the HDR could really pop in the first game, two looks, as Chris said, almost glossy. Mm-hmm. It's gorgeous. Oh, yeah. That's why ME2 is still arguably one of my favorites, because of the visual change.
Yeah, that art design really holds up. I remain shocked that a game, you know, more or less designed to look lifelike, still looks this good 17 years later.
Yeah. Also, did anyone else play Melee?
This is Mass Effect Legendary Edition.
Oh. With HDR, and find as many VIs to flash super bright.
I did. I know exactly what Jerathan's talking about here. It wasn't, truth be told, for me, it wasn't just VIs. It was a problem, at least that I encountered, mm-hmm. in the Legendary Edition. It seemed tied to going into sleep mode.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it? So on the Xbox Series X, I don't know what platform you played it on, Jerathan, but on the Xbox Series X, you can't use Quick Resume with the Legendary Edition. But if I recall correctly, you can go into sleep mode. And if you would start it back up, sometimes characters would have a bizarre gloss over them, like a shiny gloss.
Interesting.
It's funny, as I'm saying this out loud, I think I might be remembering a different game. But when he wrote this, I thought, oh, yeah, it's that. I don't know.
I played the Legendary Edition. I don't think I turned HDR on.
I don't remember if I did.
I've found HDR to be a much more finicky experience than I wanted. I get this is a tangent, but I bought a new monitor a while back because I wanted HDR because my graphics card and everything supported it.
It's great when it works.
Mm-hmm.
I have had a real hard time with it. There's like a weird thing where like some games don't like it if you have like the Windows Auto HDR turned on and they conflict and it's weird, but then some games don't support HDR natively, so you have to turn Windows HDR. It's not the plug and play experience I wanted from it. And even when I do ostensibly get it working, it is not as drastic of a difference as I feel like I was led to believe it is.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's like a configuration problem, because I've got like a fancy OLED TV, which has high contrast ratios in HDR, and that looks great. But like video games, I can never get looking good with it. So I just don't, I run everything in SDR by default now.
I'm a real nerd about this. Before I start this tangent, it just occurred to me it was Assassin's Creed 2 on the Xbox Series X was the game that I was thinking of that had the quirky gloss issue. It was not Mass Effect, so I'm sorry for my earlier error. I guess I didn't get the VI issue.
Mm-hmm.
But with regard to HDR, HDR is like a weird industry standard. that, if I recall correctly, is a proprietary industry standard, with the consequence that, for example, like PC monitors didn't have HDR for years because there was some kind of weird proprietary quirk with getting it working within Windows and with certain graphics card manufacturers. So the PC world of HDR is much more of a Wild West than the television or home console world of HDR. And that's just down to, you know, it's like smartphones, right? Extremely different use cases producing extremely varied results. So that's why I've never fooled around with HDR on a PC. But when it comes to home consoles, even there, it's a little spotty. So I am a big booster of HDR when it works well, because I love the richness of black colors. I don't know if that's, you know, the deepness of the black shade on analog media that once you got to digital and HD media went away. If you look at early HD media, you can see gradients of light and shadow a lot worse than you could in analog media. And so HDR was kind of a corrective to that, which I really liked in the 2010s. But different consoles do it much better or worse than others. Like the PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X, I find work pretty well with HDR on my, I don't know, not top of the line, like $400 TCL television. But if I try to use HDR on my Switch 2, it's a disaster. It makes everything washed out and unpleasant looking. So I have my Switch 2 set consistently to SDR. And, like, how much is it your TV settings affecting this? How much of it is the environment you're watching it in? How much of it is the device or the cable? There's just too many components in it for me to feel confident that, like, is it a Switch 2 issue? Is it the settings I'm using? I'm not even sure. But I think that's why PC HDR has been a lot less consistent over the last 20 years, or 10 years anyway.
It's really interesting because, like, I think I put HDR, like, when it kind of automatically comes on. I've never really paid that close attention to it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
At least in this game, though, there's not a whole lot of flashing that I think I went through. Because Jeff notes that playing it felt like an epilepsy stress test.
Yeah.
But now that you mention it, I should look into that a bit more, because there are some games, especially ones that are, like, remastered, mm-hmm. that have, like, these weird kind of flashing effects, or, like, I don't know, characters are, like, jumped into a pile of lube and they just look weird.
Like Assassin's Creed 2, for example.
Yeah. So yeah. I wonder if that's the case of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of weird quirks going on behind the scenes, not least of which is that, especially for remastered games, these were not games made with HDR in mind the first go-round.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot like a movie being shot for regular film and then being converted to 3D,
mm-hmm.
or converted to black and white. It just, it doesn't look like a work crafted for that to be the visual interpretation of it at the end, which is kind of unfortunate. You know, for like a really good visual experience, you want something to be displayed using as close to the technology as intended for the era in which it was created. That's my nerd opinion on it.
Yeah. But really fast, just kind of wrapping up kind of the comment.
Right.
It's a great one, by the way. I totally agree with you, Jarethan, on the Seraph offing himself, which is kind of interesting because we talked about recently, if it hasn't come out yet, a similar event happens in ME3.
Oh yeah, that's out. Our whole Mass Effect 3 run is currently available to listeners. Yep.
Okay, so the Elusive Man is kind of like the same feel,
mm-hmm.
but it definitely hit a bit more with Saren, especially since, like, I think he kind of started us off. I'm trying to figure out what the wording is. Like, he's also someone that felt like he was doing the right thing, but I think
right.
by the time the Elusive Man came, it'd already been done. While Saren's kind of sticks fresh into your mind, he's just like, oh, I really am the bad guy. I really have been taken over. These thoughts aren't my own. And I still have the image in my head. So it was a great scene. It was great character development for him, I think.
Yeah, I agree. My only beef with it was I would have preferred a scenario where if he kills himself, then there's no boss fight.
Yeah.
I would have preferred them to eschew the traditional video game boss fight in mm-hmm. favor of you. Like, the boss fight is talking to him. But
yeah.
that's really... That would have been pretty bold for a console RPG in 2007. So, you know, we're working with what we have.
It's interesting.
Our next comment here is from patron Cedric the Owl. Pharos is the site of my biggest mistake in my entire playthrough of the trilogy, but also where I really warmed to Tali as a character. Since we were fighting Geth, I decided to go heavy on tech characters for the assault on Exo-Jenny. I played Infiltrator, tech/sniper, and brought Tali and Garrus to get maximum exploitation of the Geth's weaknesses. That worked great, right up until the Thorian zombies showed up. We had nothing to slow them down from just swarming us in each encounter, and our supply of healing items was running out faster than we could replenish them. Worst of all, I couldn't switch party members because the Normandy was sealed up to avoid being infected by the spores. I thought I was going to lose hours of progress until I found a shotgun mod for Tali that caused knockback. With that equipped, she could down the zombies while Garrus and I finished them off, which was exactly what we needed to turn the tide in the second half of Pharos. Before then, Tali seemed nice, but was just kind of there. But after she saved my bacon, I was much more invested in her. Thankfully, the sequels would expand on her role on the team. Duly noted. And I am going to get raked over the coals in these comments later on for how Tali's story went in my game. But, you know, it's good to see people appreciating Tali. I think, you know, depending on the day you ask me, she's my favorite Mass Effect companion. I really like her. Even if she is a little vanilla in Mass Effect 1, everybody's mm-hmm. a little vanilla in Mass Effect 1, right?
Yeah. And I use Tali a lot. Like, she is one of my favorite characters to use, especially in ME3.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, she's your perfect companion if you are the engineer spec.
Right.
Or class. Because you just spam drones all day. It's great.
Yeah, also Shotgun Hacker is a really rad archetype that I haven't encountered in any other media. Alright, everybody, let's move along to Mass Effect 2. You want to take the top comment here, Spencer?
Sure. Cedric the Owl again. We appreciate all your feedback. Great episode. But of course, I have to rep for Sierra on the import character between games feature.
Oh yeah, this is cool.
Yeah, the Quest for Glory series, their adventure game RPG hybrid series, lets you import your character from previous games, preserving their stats, skill levels, spells, class, and even inventory in most games. It's not a perfect system. There's a bug wherein the second game will set several progress flags for the fighter path if you have a shield in your inventory, even if you're a wizard. But it's cool to have the exact character you made in 1989 be imported into the last game in 1998.
That's incredible. Have either of you played Quest for Glory?
I have not.
I have not either.
I haven't either. Like, this is all those, like, Ultima, Quest for Glory, King's Quest, all of those, like, kind of rooted in the 1980s computer games are like a foreign country to me. I always plan to explore them, but haven't gotten the chance yet.
Yeah, that was kind of before my foray into PC gaming. So the only ones I've played are ones I've kind of had the impetus to, like, go back and try. So some of the Ultima games, like Daggerfall.
Yeah, I fiddled around with, like, Wizardry, I think, is really rad, and Ultima has its moments. I haven't played around with really any of, like, the clickable adventure games, like, you know, Quest for Glory, King's Quest, even Return to Monkey Island, or whatever it is. Monkey Island, I haven't really played
I played Monkey
with.
Island.
Monkey Island is great. Yeah. My understanding is that it's, like, pretty different from adventure games of the time, in that can't regularly lock yourself out from completing it. But, you know, it's funny. I like that game.
Yeah,
that's, There's like a remake on Steam that I think goes on deep discount pretty regularly.
Yeah, and the new one's really good. I have played the new one that's on Switch. That's very fun and playable. It's funny with like modern kind of touchscreen interfaces. I think you could get a lot of these old games running. It's just I don't know if there's not like the market for it. But I'd love to see some of these old like Ultima. I really do appreciate. We finally got a remake of the original Wizardry on modern hardware. So I hope that kind of trend continues, because there's a lot of gold in them thar 1980s hills, even if I haven't explored it. I do remember this comment was in response to us saying that we hadn't encountered anything like Mass Effect 2 that lets you import your character from Mass Effect 1. And I remember at the time saying, I think Suikoden 2 let you do that, and I was wrong. I have since played Suikoden 2. And while it does let you import some world state elements from Suikoden 1, some little like bonuses, it doesn't have quite the complexity that Mass Effect 2 does.
Well, I remember you can do this with between Baldur's Gate 1 and 2, which predates Mass Effect.
Oh, shoot. Is that the truth?
I'm pretty sure. I know you can export and import characters in Baldur's Gate 1.
Yeah, because your player character in Mass Effect 2 is straight from... not Mass Effect. Your player character in Baldur's Gate 2 is straight from Baldur's Gate 1, isn't it?
Yeah.
Huh. See, good point. That was also something that I didn't remember.
Interesting.
Hamilton, you want to get this next comment here?
So, Jason says, somehow I completely missed Arrival in this playthrough. I just never saw it. It was strange. But I feel like the trial at the start of ME3 was more about Cerberus involvement than anything else. And yeah, I'm not going back. Two, the first time I played the trilogy, I was kind of miffed by Liara's standoffish behavior. So my check went with Miranda. Same. Told you, we're one the same.
Clearly.
Who looked much more normal in OG ME2, I swear. Yeah, you're weird.
I don't remember any of this. I remember the original versions of the games almost universally looking worse, but I haven't gone back to them in a long time, so your mileage may vary.
But yeah, and then Liara was like, wow, really? Her? And all I could think was, we were on a break.
We were on a break! That's my best Ross from Friends impression.
Not you, it's me. I mean, it's not me, it's you. I messed that up. The DLC being integrated into the main game, not down the line, makes for a possibly much more organic flow. Totally agree.
Yeah.
Especially since Liara is heavily involved in Shepard's resurrection, such as it is. I went with Tali this time, just for a change of pace. It feels wrong. Liara and Shepard are meant to be.
As my playthrough clearly indicated.
Right? And Liara was much less upset about that, including into ME3. Though I haven't run into Tali yet. Three. The first time I played ME, I also missed the moon somehow. And Uranus, lol. And the sequel. I've never done that. Also lol.
I had to hear about it. It was only on this playthrough that I finally tried it, because other people literally in the comments to our shows told me that I had to try it.
I remember if I did or not. Everyone should try Uranus.
Yeah, it's very cute. Everybody should try Uranus sooner or later.
Exactly. Which is wild. The game locks further specialization behind it. This last time I actually snagged the beat the majority of the game trophy. I wonder if I did that. Maybe. Leaving the universe completely scoured. And man, that was some work. But the moon should be nearly mandatory. Not a thing that's just kind of there. Point four. My Shepard fell off the platform to the end of the final fight. I did too!
No, I guess the
Reaper. I did! We really are the same person.
I love this for you, Hamilton.
Oh, it made me so mad. Because I swear I was like close to the end of the fight too. And I don't remember if it like lets you spawn halfway between the fight ending or at the start the very beginning, but I fell off as well. And going back to Jared's comment, and that meant I was like scaffolding below or on the scaffolding below, just shooting the damage points when the creature would move down as part of its animations. It was weird. I didn't have janky animations. I think it just died.
That's incredible. I love glitches like that. Those really make my day. It's really hard to express how much I appreciate glitches like that.
Yeah, no, I fell through, I believe.
Yeah.
Because I guess, like, maybe you glitched into the scaffolding below, but I just fell off of something, mm-hmm. and I just plummeted to my death.
That's wild. I still remember the time when a door didn't spawn in one of the towns in Skyrim for me. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, that's odd. I'll just wander outside and see what it is. And the landscape just gets decreasingly detailed as you walk further away until it becomes this weird, like, gray sludge at the distance from the city that you couldn't see it when you left. It's, gosh, I love glitches like that.
I just remember throwing my hands up.
What are you going to do?
I was like, really?
Yeah. Next comment here is from House Speaker Hound. The lasting power of Mass Effect 2 comes down to something so many RPGs struggle with. Pacing. A major mission is about the length of an average drama episode. It creates the feeling something is being completed. And while the story and dialogue aren't as good as most fans say, the average voice acting and cutscene direction sells even the weakest of lines or scenes. Now, it has its flaws. Biotics are often useless. Vanguard is always useless. True story, I played as Vanguard in one of these games. It's pretty rough. Jacob is simultaneously unpleasant and boring, duly noted.
Yep.
And DLC doesn't acknowledge companions, the best aspect of BioWare. But Mass Effect 2 is among the best games ever made, despite that.
I agree.
Yeah, good insights, House Speaker Hound.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, Mass Effect... I was going to say Mass Effect 2, but really the Mass Effect trilogy is a perfect case of better than the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can reasonably criticize lots of elements of the series, and Lord knows we have over the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, they're very engaging and fun to play. Like, you feel good having played them.
I'll say this. Mass Effect, I don't know if I would replay Mass Effect 2, even though I rate it as, like, my favorite.
Yeah,
among the Mass Effects, and usually that's for the shock value. Like, right. Again, from ME1 to ME2. But yes, it is run down the corridor of the game. I would argue to say that the fighting wasn't even all that special.
No.
It was more the lore for me.
Yeah.
And just the ability to explore. It was new.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that really kind of, like, they hit it out of the park for me. But yeah, it certainly is. It isn't without its flaws.
Spencer, you want to cover the next comment here?
Sure. From Ham Salad.
Great name.
Hello.
ME2 really was a fantastic game. I replayed it a couple times to get the best good and bad endings I could. The characters were top-notch, the side missions were immensely satisfying, even though the main mission was fairly blah, and the combat was fantastic. It was BioWare at the height of their powers. I have to say, though, that I really wish that my disappointment with how they ended the story arc in ME3 didn't hang over this game as much as it does. The developers promised choices would matter, and that it would not end with a generic choose A, B, or C ending. And that's just what they did, in the most generic Deus Ex Machina way they possibly could. I still haven't replayed ME2 once since the third one came out. I'm still too bitter. I'm sure one day I'll get over it and explore this gem of a game again.
You're in good company, Ham Salad.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I ME2 is the best of the bunch, I think. I mean, I had a kid. I didn't have to finish Mass Effect 3 this time. So
somebody hasn't listened to our conclusions on the game, Spencer.
What? Who? I listen to the show that you guys do without me.
What? Mass Effect 3 ended up being my favorite this time, believe it or not.
There's stuff to like about... I mean, I like the gameplay of 3.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get deep enough into it for the show... I remember the first time I went through it, really getting lost in the weeds on the, like, multiplayer, like, galaxy mechanic. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of curious to see how that was handled now that presumably the multiplayer aspect is dead.
Yeah, I was going to say, you'd be happy to discover that it doesn't exist anymore. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, how they handled it is reducing the threshold for getting the good ending by, like, half. So it's just much easier to get the good ending now without... since you can't do any of the multiplayer or heaven forfend Facebook tie-in game.
I know the last thing we need is more tangents, but did you mess around with the multiplayer at all in your Metal Gear Solid 5 playthrough?
No, I didn't. And I didn't do that in Peace Walker either. Yeah, I'll tell you, Hamilton. The Metal Gear Solid 5 multiplayer is still at least nominally active.
Really?
Because I was regularly getting pop-ups about new events that had started within, like the last few months, it looked like.
Well, how about that? All right.
Hamilton, take the next one.
This comes from, if God is 7, then Cat is 8.
Yeah.
I thought that that was the beginning of a comment. Nope. I was like, I have no idea what this is coming from.
Nope. I'm sure it means something. I'm just not clued into what.
Well, dog is, or God is dog backwards. I don't know. Maybe you like cats more than dogs.
Maybe Mouse is 9.
Maybe. Hmm. But they say, changes I liked. Removable heat sinks instead of waiting for cooldowns. Mm-hmm. Very much so. Very much so. Planet scanning. Not a fan of the Mako. No one is. Or Mako, or however you pronounce it.
It was more fun when the physics were worse.
At least you could laugh at how bad it was.
Mm-hmm.
But what else do they like? They like the more action. Mm-hmm. More run and gun cover mechanic. More variety between classes. An ME... Nothing much stands out in the classes like Vanguard or Sentinels. The hodgepodge mix of two-thirds basic roles. Yeah.
Too true.
Very true. And de-emphasizing the skill system so much that you could be locked out of combo choices if you didn't play your points right in ME1.
Yeah.
Just one change I kind of sort of didn't like. I feel like ME1 had more space horror feel and would have liked to continue that in ME2.
Mm-hmm.
I think in ME2, it was definitely more like... like Alien, not Alien 2, but like more of like this, the space marines actually running, gunning action. While the first one, you're kind of exploring kind of creepy places. I can see where you're coming with that.
Hamilton, have you continued reading this comment? I think you're going to like where it goes.
Oh, I haven't. It was like going from aliens to alien to aliens. Oh my gosh. I didn't even read it yet.
That's awesome.
Oh my gosh. I am one with my listeners.
You really are.
One with the commenters.
That's awesome.
That is hilarious. And that's it, they say. But there's more to the comment. Can you tell this is one of my favorite games of all time? I would also confidently vouch for the ending of ME2 as one of the best endings of any entertainment property ever, be it film, TV, book, etc.
Mm-hmm.
The music absolutely slaps. Great music, for sure. The reveal is brilliant. Actually, the entire sequence from the final mission on, masterpiece. BioWare were the kings of in-game cinematic cutscenes, and this remains their crowning achievement.
It really is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think if you ask 10 people what BioWare's best game was, 9 of them would say Mass Effect 2.
I'm a fan.
Yeah. They really stuck the landing with that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, a lot of it is the cutscenes. Like, there is a type of video game player that is loath to enjoy non-interactive segments, and I get that. Mm-hmm. You know, depending on the time of day, I am one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really impressive when, like, a game cutscene sticks the landing and is as good as something you'd see in film.
No, spot on, especially the intro stage. We're crawling through, you know, a broken, burning... Normandy.
Oh, yeah.
That still sticks out to me to this day.
But the intro to ME2 is fantastic.
Fantastic.
Yeah, they out-Kojima'd Kojima with that one.
Mm-hmm.
Next comment from Cedric the Owl. I, too, got the awkward ex conversation with Ashley on Horizon. Amidst all the talk about her racism, a lot of people seem to forget that her entire arc in Mass Effect 1 is unlearning that. And then she finds you working with the people she hated, even at her Earth firstest. I'd be pissed in her situation, too. Something I learned very recently is that Ambassador Udina is voiced by Bill Ratner, the same guy who played Flint in the 80s G.I. Joe cartoon.
Oh, that's cool.
Did either of you watch that? I haven't seen the 80s G.I. Joe cartoon.
Well, I did. I don't remember it super well, but...
I just know Cobra's always there going like, eh, heh, 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 or whatever.
Cobra Commander, something like that. I don't
something
know.
Like that, yeah. Everybody's always shooting guns, but nobody gets shot. It's really magical.
I had a friend that had some kind of weird, like, interactive TV board game with G.I. Joe.
Huh.
I remember, so I had, oh, wow, this is a relic of the era we grew up.
I'll bet I know what you're going to say, and I'm going to be really shocked if
Gargoyles?
Yes! Holy
yes!
Crap.
Of course. So good.
Of course, yep. Spencer. Of course you and I both had the interactive Gargoyles board game.
We need to source one of these and play it for the show, because the idea of like a board game with like a companion VHS component is just such a relic of like the
Can you
90s.
Get one of those anymore? I don't even know. I don't see that kind of thing on eBay.
It would be hard to find a working one, I'm sure, because VHS tapes have a shelf life.
Right. There's a lot of little pieces. I am so tickled, because I was just talking about that Gargoyles VHS board game and nobody knew what in the world I was talking about. And of course you would, because we are the same person.
There's one being sold by a third party on Amazon for $150.
Not buying that.
Oof, oof.
It wasn't that good when I played it when I was a kid.
Wait, why is one of these listed for 150 and one is listed for 20?
Does not contain VHS or board game.
Yeah, does not contain anything.
I think based on the pictures, I think one is just the VHS tape. The other one does include the board game. We need the board game. We got. Yeah. If I source one of these, we're playing it.
I'd play it.
I do too.
That'd be a real blast from the past. I haven't touched that since, 1998? I got distracted here. Something I learned very recently is that Ambassador Udina is voiced by Bill Ratner, the same guy who played Flint in the 80s G.I. Joe cartoon. When this game was new, I got big laughs from my friends by imitating the assuming direct control line in my Goofy impression. Does anybody want to hear me try to do a Goofy impression of this?
Do it to us.
Assuming direct control. No, that wasn't very good.
It was great. What are you talking about?
I might cut that out.
No.
I can't. Hey, Hamilton, what's your Goofy impression? Give me an assuming direct control.
Gorsh. Assuming direct control.
Well.
Yeah.
The inclusion of the Gorsh really sold it.
That was a quality impression, Hamilton. Okay, Spencer, let's get our next comment here.
Okay. The way that was structured, at first I thought his name was I Am Sancho Favorite Recruitment Mission.
Oh yeah, there's two colons.
I love his name.
So I Am Sancho Favorite Recruitment Mission, Garrus. When I first played all those many years ago, I didn't see the Archangel twist coming, so it was a genuine thrill to see my old squadmate again, and the setup of having to turtle up and defend felt like a nice twist from all the charging into enemies guns ablazing. Least favorite recruitment mission, Grunt. I get what they were going for, the massive starship deconstruction yards, but it's pretty blah in the eyes. Mm. And there's a lot of technobabble about how Grunt got to be there, which is a shame, because I really love Grunt. Favorite loyalty mission, Morden. Solus's loyalty mission is so tied to his character and his evolving beliefs about one of Emmy's most morally thorny ideas, and really brought the character into focus beyond kooky scientist. Least favorite loyalty mission, Samara. While I genuinely like her, her mission had no action, felt very hard to fail, and the final decision, while clever, ultimately hinged on you having a high enough Paragon or Renegade score.
It's a genuine testament to how bad I am at so many games that I did manage to fail Samara's loyalty mission. It's the one that I had to replay.
So the stuff with the art at Yakshi, that's her loyalty mission, right? Not her recruitment mission?
I think the loyalty is isn't it the art at Yakshi?
Yeah, the loyalty is where you and her trail Marant through Omega.
Yeah, okay, because when you recruit her, it's during that stupid, like, Volus murder at the docks.
Yeah. Thing.
Yeah, okay, and then going after her daughter is the loyalty mission. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of liked her loyalty mission. Like, nothing that Sancho says is wrong about it, but I still thought it was, like, kind of neat.
Right.
Like, it gave Samara, like, some depth of character. Like, I don't know, it was a cool character beat, having to essentially put down her own daughter, which kind of, like, that sucks. The character of Morinth was, like, kind of cool. The audio logs from that, like, random girl that got, like, seduced and killed by Morinth was, like, pretty heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah, that was really cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, truth be told, I agree with you, Spencer. I liked it as kind of a weird detective side mission. But I don't know how much of that was the writing and how much of it was just the fact that it wasn't another corridor shooting section. You know, that went a long way for me.
And then obviously Morden is just the best at everything. I think This playthrough of Mass Effect 3 was like the most ideal playthrough of Mass Effect 3 you can have, where I played up through Morden's mission and then stopped.
Oh, yeah. You got all the best parts of it.
Oh, yeah. That was the conclusion to the Mass Effect franchise in my heart, is just, you know, the conclusion to Morden's story. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yep.
Our next comment comes from Terry Brunson, saying, "The second game does a good job of humanizing the Geth. I was pro-Quarian until I learned that the Quarians practiced chattel slavery on the Geth. Then I was like, maybe the Quarians should have been banished from their home planet." Big same, Terry.
Did they establish how sentient the Geth were at first? I thought it was like kind of like a Skynet situation where they kind of turned sentient.
Yes, it's a whole thing in Mass Effect 3. Yeah. We might have a comment related to that in our Mass Effect 3 section. But yeah, you do get all of the background on the like logistics of them turning sentient in Mass Effect 3.
Okay.
All right, Spencer, you want to do this next comment here?
Sure. Another one from Jarethan.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I played the game, I made Morden the leader of the hostage evacuation, and it went poorly. Surely a member of the STG could ferry folks to safety, right? 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 Usually I have Samara run the barrier, though sometimes it's Jack, but I can't say I ever thought to let anyone else run that. And these days I usually let Garrus run Squad B, though maybe it's Jacob I sent back with the crew, civvies, whatever. When I replayed the trilogy this year, the final fight went strangely. As you start to fight the Terminator and stuff's flying around, I backed up a step too far and fell into the scaffolding support structure below the platforms. And it turns out, not only does the fight continue, you can still damage the big bad from your vantage point, and no one can touch you. It's not the way I wanted it to go, but I didn't want to start the entire encounter over. I have a similar story for the Citadel DLC and ME3, I'll save for them. This replay of ME2 this year did take the game down just a bit for me. The non-combat missions, while good for variety, didn't always play well. Mm-hmm. Thane's loyalty mission especially felt weirdly built, and I had to restart at one point when it glitched because nothing was happening. Glitches were definitely part of the Mass Effect Legendary Legendary Edition experience on PS4 overall. The Hammerhead missions were absolute filler. The mining was great for podcast listening. As a longtime fan of Liara, it felt deeply strange to build a relationship with another crew member, especially if you're familiar with BioWare's work before that, and she feels like a slightly aged up Mission Vow.
I assume Mission Vow is probably from Knights of the Old Republic?
Yeah, that's a KOTOR character.
Oh, okay. Have you played those?
I played them. I admittedly had to Google it. Played them a long time ago. I played them back on like Xbox when they were new. I haven't revisited them in a long time.
Did you know that they've ported those via backwards compatibility and you can just straight up play those original Xbox games on modern Xboxes?
I'm not surprised. Those games are beloved.
Yeah, God bless them. Also, the modern remastered versions are excellent. The KOTOR games are much more accessible than you would expect for a computer role-playing game of the early 2000s. All of these comments about the glitches really make me grateful that I was playing on the Xbox. I encountered virtually no glitches the entire time, which I guess maybe reflects that these were built for like PC and Xbox first. I don't know.
Yeah. The only one, I mean, maybe I went to more glitches with the PS5, because that's what I played it on. But the only one that really stood out to me was the stupid, as Jarethan put it, the Terminator.
Yeah, that's a great... Kudos on the Terminator.
Or the final boss, where I just plummeted to my death. And that was very annoying.
I guess I did get, like, a narrative-breaking glitch where Captain A or whatever showed up in my final rousing cutscene.
I was about to say, like, you got one of the greatest ones of all time.
Yeah, that's amazing. Hamilton, you want to read this next comment?
Yeah. So this is another one from Kai Jigger Desu. As a BioWare veteran, by the time I played this, I knew I had to do my loyalty mission before the final mission, so no way died.
Mm-hmm.
I think I still looked into guides about who does what, because some decisions are not that obvious. I don't know, what is lead speak? What is IRC?
If I recall correctly.
Ah?
Mm-hmm.
I'm old, sorry.
I use that one a lot. Yeah.
The mission itself was great, but the last boss is a bit of a disappointment. I think the end game of ME1 is stronger, especially when you can do the Bakko run.
That actually is kind of cool. Yeah, you know,
it is.
I find it easy to dunk on the Mako, but that bit where you're like, you're driving it through the falling apart planet, like the Prothean planet, as you head towards the portal.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm a sucker for that kind of bombast.
It is kind of cool.
Yeah, a little bit of Halo energy, you know?
Halo energy.
Yeah.
I have no clue how far I am from the consensus on this. Shadow Broker has some fun Easter eggs and, of course, ends up being a big change for Liara. Mm-hmm. I played after the last mission for the first time, and I think that's the canon way to do it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's clearly intended to be post-story. Like, in the Legendary Edition, you can do it before the end of the game, and I guess arguably you need to.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know how that works with carrying over your save file, so I did it before the end of the game this time. But back when I played it the original time, I did it afterwards, and it's a pretty good epilogue.
I think I did mine before,
mm-hmm.
but also, like, I didn't know what was DLC from what is not.
Right, exactly.
So I kind of just played whatever came my way. But Jevin, or Kai Digger Desu says, it was probably one of the most impactful DLC story-wise of the whole series.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I would argue, maybe unreasonably, that Lair of the Shadow Broker is, in the wider industry, the moment where DLC became a more important component of games.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember being there for that and having this sense of, like, well, yeah, you've played Mass Effect 2, but you haven't gotten the whole story unless you've played Lair of the Shadow Broker, which could come across as, like, a crass marketing ploy, but there's a truth to that, and Lair of the Shadow Broker definitely earned the $20 that you'd spend on it back at the time, like, between the cool setting, the cool plot, and then an entirely new monster or, you know, alien that wasn't present in the rest of the series.
I mean, I would have spent it for it. I think it's well worth it.
Oh, yeah. Our last comment here is from...
Love the name.
Coma the Doof Warrior. They write, I did a run through where I romanced Liara, and Shadow Broker is easily the best part of that romance arc. In fact, it might be the best part of Liara's whole story in general. Fun, your mileage may vary, fact. That time I played Shadow Broker midway through the game and ended up having to go back and restart Mass Effect 2 entirely because I hadn't realized I'd initiated a romance with Garrus until Liara confronted me about it. I can relate. As a person who the game consistently told me had romanced Liara, despite no evidence to support that theory, I can relate, Coma the Doof Warrior. Every time I'd spoken to Garrus, I had gone with what seemed like the most fun response. It turned out I was only about a line or two away from getting to the let's bang, okay, part of the dialogue tree. I didn't want my Shep to have emotionally cheated on Liara, and I didn't have a save far enough back, so I just went back to the beginning. Brutal.
Well, you know, I commend your loyalty, though, mm-hmm. To the romance.
And that's that for the first half of our mailbag. We really appreciate all the great feedback you've given us all season. Podcasting doesn't come with a built-in audience, so it means a lot that so many folks have gone on this journey with us. We look forward to checking out your responses to Mass Effect 3 and Andromeda later in the season. Once again, we've been your hosts, Chris,
Spencer,
and I'm Hamilton.
Thanks for listening, folks. Goodbye.